Good afternoon, everyone. We're ready to begin the expanded budget committee for September 26th. And excuse me, up first is Tompkins Community Action. Please come to the end of the desk and begin your program.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. Thank you for the opportunity to present our request. I'm Lee Dillon. I'm Executive Director of Tompkins Community Action, and this is Carrie Berman, our Deputy Director and CFO. This is the recommended budget. TC Action has the ability to accomplish significant projects, for example, creating new sites and expanding our local child care opportunities, new classrooms, building and implementing new and ongoing supportive housing programs for people experiencing homelessness, engaging people who need assistance and wish to move forward with their lives, helping children secure the services they need, providing food and nutritional educational activities through our successful Victory Garden, Harvest Dinner Series, and the implementation of integrating Head Start and supportive housing programming. We have also significant grant writing capability and have been very successful in securing local, county, state, and federal grants, as you may have recently seen in a local press with the Amici House and the Child Care Center. This slide, poverty in Tompkins County, according to the American Community Survey, five-year estimates, an average of 20.59% of all persons in Tompkins County lived in the state of poverty during the 2010-2014 period. The poverty rate for all persons living in Tompkins County is greater than the national average of 15.59%. We implement supportive housing for people experiencing homelessness located within the highest concentration of poverty areas in the city of Ithaca, close to resources and services, and we purposely plan our large child care centers with resource centers in high concentration areas of poverty and have been able to increase access to vital mental health, physical health, VITA services to the centers with our community partners, Family and Children's, AFCU, and Finger Lakes Community Health, to name a couple. This slide represents the population in poverty by gender. Again, we're a little higher than the national average of 15.59. Numbers are a little small on this slide, sorry. In federal fiscal year 2016, TC Action collected demographic data on and served 5,179 very low-income individual Tompkins County residents. These are a few of the characteristics that we collected. Carrie, do you want to talk a little bit about our Sally G. DeLay Child Care Center? Just opened?
It's just opened. This was a collaborative effort with Ithaca Neighborhood Housing. We have three early childhood, which is serves pregnant moms through age three classrooms, a full kitchen and support staff and training space. So these are the three classrooms, and the top left-hand corner is the entryway. Also has a playground for Early Head Start kids. 28 children and their families, are being served there. All of those families, at the time of their application, were living at 100% of the federal poverty line. This center also created four new positions in the program. That resulted actually in four promotions from teacher assistants to teachers. Three of those promotions were of current and former Head Start parents. And of the four positions that were replaced in the program, three of those new hires were Head Start parents who were unemployed, two of which were single mothers with children in the program. And those are living wage jobs with benefits and continued training opportunities once they're a part of the program. So we're very excited about this new site. It's named after our board president. Who
will be, her term is ending the end of the year. Hopefully she'll just go away for 1 year and we can get her back. But Sally's been a great force. 16 years? Yes. Yes. And this is her second round of 16 years.
Is that Hank's wife?
Yes, it is Hank's wife.
What's her last name?
Delay.
I thought
she had Sally another last Delay.
I thought she had another last name. Okay, good.
She probably did.
I know, I mean that she used another last name.
Yeah, no, not that I... Not since we've known her.
Kara, please use the microphone, okay?
This talks about our over-target request. Do you want to go for that?
Can you skip over a slide?
Yeah, we have full-time equivalents.
Kevin. Kevin.
So, my apologies. When we sent out the templates, the pre-populated templates, we sent the same templates to both agencies and departments, and the FTE slide is really a departments only kind of thing. So your information about the FTEs for agencies is program by program in their program summaries, but we don't ask the agencies to do a formal FTE slide in a sense. So before the show here, we agreed to hide that slide just to even things out. That's why you don't see it, but it's in your packet.
Thanks for the explanation.
You bet.
So is it accurate or not? Oh, okay.
We filled it out. The reasoning, we lost some monies in our weatherization department, or weatherization assistance program, and that's why we lost four staff because of downgrading in that grant. So we're requesting $100,000 from Tompkins County Legislature to assist with the necessary repairs to the roof and heating, ventilation, and air conditioning system at our main offices at 701 Spencer Road. After 17 years of service to TC Action, no amount of preventative maintenance can remedy the inherent failures of our heating and cooling equipment. The HVAC rooftop system providing heating and cooling to our facility is unreliable, energy inefficient, and consistently prone to failure. Maintenance and upkeep have been a costly problem to our agency, one that deflects financial resources away from where they belong to provide cost-effective services to our consumers. Frequently, direct client services must be rescheduled or relocated to conform to the absence of heat or air conditioning. So we're requesting this as an OTR. As a result of a funding shortfall in our recent construction award from New York State Homes and Community Renewal. We also wrote this request in the, I don't know if you're aware of the nonprofit infrastructure grant application that the governor put out last year. We were unsuccessful in that bid, but what we did put this in for funding to the governor. What else are we saying here? The building serves also as an agency, our own agency staff training center, and we regularly offer our community room, which is a large room. I don't know if many of you have been there, a large room for free training space throughout the year.
We put out requests for estimates from a number of providers, and the HVC system itself, we're getting numbers at about $125,000 for the HVAC system. We would apply for a NYSERDA E-TAC program rebate of about $16,000, so that would bring the cost to about $110,000. And then the roof membrane that would have to be replaced as well would be $90,000, so it's about $200,000. And we have a commitment from M&T Bank for half of that money, so we're coming to the legislature and asking for the other half as a one-time over-target request.
M&T is a loan. Yep.
Yeah.
Yep.
And M&T Bank often will fund projects for us through their community investment funds. So the interest rates that they charge, as well as fees and all of that stuff, are significantly reduced. It's not a commercial rate loan.
ETEC means Emerging Technologies with Accelerated Commercialization, and we would get about $16,000 back from that.
And the systems we're looking at generate
about $4,700 worth of savings a year if we change the system, and our return on investment is about 3.88 years.
Well, let's wait till the end.
Okay. That's a picture of 701 Spencer Road that I took. Someone said it was a horrible picture. Amici House and the Harriet Janellis Child Care Center. TC Action was successful in securing over $8.5 million from New York State Homes and Community Renewal, New York State Homeless Housing Assistance Program, Tompkins County Community Development Housing Fund, Federal Home Loan Bank, private grants, and some commercial loans to build supportive housing program for youth 18 to 25 years of age experiencing homelessness, and a large child care center on the property. All this is on the same property as our existing building that we need a new roof and HVAC system. We hope to close with our funders the end of October and start construction in November. Let's see. Young people facing homelessness face particular challenges as there is no group home facility within the county for homeless youth who need an independent, supervised, and supportive environment. Youth often feel unsafe or are restricted by age from traditional homeless shelters and are less likely to be officially counted in homelessness statistics. Although the Learning Web provides 15 transitional housing apartments for youth 18 to 24, it is serving an additional 50 to 60 homeless youth per quarter as best it can without adequate housing options. My last check, which about 30 days ago, was there are 33 people within this age range experiencing homelessness in the Tompkins County new community-wide coordinated assessment wait list. Harriet Janellis was our CFO for 26 years, and she passed away in 2013, and we are naming the child care center after Harriet. Carrie, would you like to talk about the child care rooms at the child care center?
We'll have 5 classrooms and a full kitchen at the Harriet Janellis Center. This will also be an early Head Start facility serving pregnant women to 3 years of age. So there will be 48, depending on the needs, it could go as high as 50. We can have 10 children in the room, in each room. If they are infants, which is 6 weeks to 1 year, that ratio goes down to 8. So that will depend on applications. The facility will provide space for staff trainings, for children's screenings, for parent-teacher conferences, parent trainings, parent action group meetings, which is similar to a PTA, and policy council meeting space as well, and a playground dedicated to the program, as always.
That's our presentation.
Thank you. Rich and Martha had their hands up. Go ahead, Rich.
You mentioned the energy savings. I assume you also have a cost for maintenance and repair that you've been incurring. Do you have any estimate how much you'll save on that?
I don't have that number. I could get that for you, though. I do know that SureTemp has a permanent parking space in the back of our building.
No, that's okay. That's all right.
Okay.
Martha.
Thanks. Are you, so you've got NYSERDA involved. Are you thinking of heat pumps by any chance? Because that provides air conditioning at the same time as heating. Renewable energy. I'm going to take
it. Would be difficult for us to go. I mean, we're doing air source heat pumps in the Amici house in the new construction.
Okay.
But we have been told that it would be very difficult for us to go into air source heat pumps for our facility.
We have to retro it.
Right. And you don't have to. I can't. Can you use the mic?
We were told that we would have to retrofit in the existing building because it's not new construction, which will increase the cost outside of a budget.
Well, there's Energize New York funding for this kind of project.
This
Joe?
Is the only funding we could get for it.
Well, I'm looking at Joe. This is a financing option that we put in place.
They could do that. Not-for-profits can do that. So it's basically a loan that gets spread and repaid through your property tax bill. It's a surcharge on your property tax bill. And even though you're tax-exempt, you get a bill, so you could still do it that way. So that could be a source.
I mean, that they retrofit. Anyway, if you could take a look, you know, maybe talk to Tatum Engineering or something.
We did bring Tatum in as a consultant on this. They're also consulting for us. They are on the Amici House and Child Care. This is their proposal to us and in their opinion, our best and only option.
Okay. All right. Thanks very much. But
Anna.
There's still the financing if that could be helpful.
Anna?
Well, I guess I was just going to follow up with that to ask. There's no ductwork right now. There wasn't as far as the systems that were currently used. So they would have to literally install all the ductwork in order to get the air source heat pumps. Is that what you were finding with Tatum, why they didn't recommend that direction?
I don't know. Okay. I'm sorry. I can't answer that question.
Okay.
We have ductwork currently. You know, the air comes through the ceiling, but...
Okay, so if you have that, then it could be retrofitted more easily than others. Just as a thought, I was curious if that was the system you had in place.
I'll certainly follow up with Tatum and ask them why they're saying that that can't be done. But
okay.
That's
anyone else? Go ahead, Will.
Well, very, very basic question. I guess it's more for Joe, but hi, folks. We don't own this building, but you've recommended that we do this. Why?
We have a historic relationship with TC Action and their building. And do we own it and lease it back to you? Is that how it currently works? So
we
years ago, remember that?
Yeah, I do remember that.
So we have this relationship. So we are the building owner, but we fully recover the cost of our debt through the lease arrangement
right.
with them. And so there has been this historic involvement with them and their physical infrastructure. I viewed this as a logical extension of that and a way to preserve this asset.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Thank you very much, both of you. Up next is soil and water. John Nagley. Joe, I only have $60 on me. Welcome, John. I just want to disclose here that Dave McKenna and myself will not ask John any very tough questions. So I'll leave that all up to the rest of you. Go ahead, John.
Thanks, Jim.
You speak for yourself, Jim.
All right, I will.
All right. Well, thank you for letting us present the 2018 Soil and Water District budget to the Tompkins County Legislature. Before I get into the details of our numbers, I just wanted to kind of give you an overview of 2017 highlights and what we've been up to. It's been a busy 2017. We have our hydroseeder that we've had for many years. We've been working with the municipalities. We have a new conservation technician on that joined us this past year. He's been working very diligently, coming in behind municipalities that have ditched their roads, seeded those down. We are trying to do some new innovative techniques with our ditch management, with the highway departments, utilizing compost to be able to filter out some of the pathogens and the nutrients that may be running down the ditch system, putting in some check dams, trying to eliminate some of that erosion, and just general education with the highway departments of if you don't need to ditch, don't, and if you do, try to do it as environmentally sensitive as you possibly can. We also work with the farm community, so we've worked with a bunch of our AEM cooperators, our agricultural environmental management cooperators, and through that program we've implemented 157 acres of cover crop, which is basically once a crop has been pulled off of a farmer's field, we like to see that green back up with some type of vegetation to hold and bind that soil in place, so that it doesn't run off in the springtime, wintertime, sending nutrients, manure, anything down into the stream systems. Another program that we've had quite a bit of success with is our Southern Tier Ag Industry Enhancement Program. In round one, we had 8 projects that were funded. We've completed 4 of those projects. 2 of them are hay storage structures. You can see in this picture here and this picture. This is out in Trumansburg. This is in Groton. Oops. We also have a cold storage packing facility. You can see the framing members going up there. This is also just outside of Trumansburg, and a solar installation on a farm running basically their entire operation off of solar now. So that's just half of round one. We also have round two. We had 10 farms awarded in round two. There's $1.5 million from the governor's office that was awarded to soil and water districts, specifically to this soil and water district in Tompkins County. And so it's been a great benefit to farmers, and they've really seen some economic improvement on their farms. So going forward into 2018, some influences that are going to affect the district and what we do, how we deliver it. The Cayuga Lake TMDL. I came to you this time last year with about the same news of where DEC was with the TMDL, the total maximum daily load for phosphorus into the south end of Cayuga Lake. You can see the picture there, and you probably have driven down 13 Route 89 into Ithaca after a heavy rainstorm event, seeing the sediment plume going into the south end of the lake. That brings along with it phosphorus, and that's what the total maximum daily load is targeting, is to trying to reduce that phosphorus load. There will be allocations across the watershed of how much phosphorus can be introduced to the south end of the lake. So that's going to increase our workload once that comes out. Once they have the models developed and the numbers generated of how much each specific sector will have as a load, there will probably be best management practices that we will have to put on the landscape with farms, stormwater practices across the urban landscape, and we have already kind of set ourselves up for that, applying for grants to the DEC, to Fish and Wildlife Service, to Ag and Markets, for well over $1 million. Those are in application. We're waiting for funding award letters to come back to us, and that will just get more best management practices out on the landscape, hopefully reducing the sediment plume, at least the phosphorus that's contained in that. One thing that we have desperately needed within the district to implement these best management practices has always been a resource engineer to be able to stamp designs, sign off on projects, give us in-house support for projects. Going out to private engineering firms has been fairly costly, and we don't have the in-house oversight over them to say what we want when they put the project in place. So we have found a retired engineer from Delaware County, Soil and Water District. He worked extensively with the New York City watershed in doing stream restoration designs down there for the city watershed, basically trying to keep their reservoirs clean for their drinking water sources. So he has put his resume out there. We snatched him up with some state aid funding for this year, and we'll hopefully be able to support him into 2018. That's one of our OTRs that I'll talk about. But this will be a definite benefit to the district. Also, we could work with the County Planning Department and the County Highway Department in some of their programs, the Natural Infrastructure Program, and within bridge stream interfaces to kind of help them out with stream designs. Another thing I just wanted to bring up was our hydrilla eradication success. This has been a great program. We've seen huge successes. The picture here on the left, going from top to bottom, left to right, these are, it's hard to see, but there's red dots there within the Cuga Inlet of where we found hydrilla in 2011. Going through the pictures, you can't see it, but there's some red circles here that have reduced the amount of hydrilla. And in 2015 and 2016, we see no hydrilla within the Cuga Inlet. So that's been a great success. We are still working in Fall Creek right here in the Golf Course Lagoon. There's about five or six specific small locations of patches of hydrilla that we're working to eradicate. They're being pretty persistent because there's high flow through Fall Creek, and we can't keep the herbicide chemicals up enough to really treat the treat the hydrilla as much as we need to. So we'll probably reconvene again, see if there's different techniques that we can use going forward. But this is a great success, and I just wanted to reiterate that to the legislature here. Another thing that you have probably already heard from the County Highway Department in their presentation is a cold storage facility that I've been talking with Jeff Smith and Aurel from facilities out at the Public Works facility. In the backyard, there's some space for a cold storage building. We have equipment, vehicles, we have hydroseeding material that sits out in the elements right now. Is very hard on our equipment and materials. It would be nice to have a cold storage facility that we would share. This would be a facility that the county owns. We would just have a long-term lease for that. We have some state aid funding that we would be able to work with the County Highway Department on a bridge repair, culvert. I think Jeff was talking about possibly Pine Tree Road. We would come in and pay for that project, offsetting the cost of this building. This slide, it's a little busy, but I just wanted to kind of give the overall health of where we are with the district. Upward trends is what you want to see, or flat lines. These lines right here are county appropriations from other districts, what the other districts' counties give them in appropriations. Cuga County is by far, across the state, the largest appropriation that they get from their county. but they also have one of the highest density of agriculture, and that county really supports them through their agricultural program. We are pretty much in the middle of the pack right here, and we've been steadily increasing our appropriation from the county. We really thank the county for that increase. That's been a great benefit to the district to be able to pull the numbers up. The bottom, the kind of valley that you see, is our net position. You see in 2011 we were at the lowest point, and we have steadily increased our net position to a positive figure. And our debt repayment to the state, we started at $380,000. We are now at $38,000. So you see a 2024 projection. If we were to pay that off by what the state wants us to pay, we see that being paid off by 2019, 2020. This slide, I just wanted to basically bring your attention to the bottom figures. The return on your investment, for every dollar that you give to the Soil and Water District, we're able to turn that into between $5 and $6 in grants and programs that we're able to apply to agencies like DEC, Fish and Wildlife, to bring best management practices back into the county. So this green box is what the county appropriation goes towards, is the operational fund of the district. These boxes here are what we bring in with that assistance. So to get to the bottom line figures, we are asking for a $114,000 increase this year. And that breaks down into a $50,000 one-time engineer costs. So that would be for 2018. You'd be able to keep the engineer employed. That's a great cost savings for an engineer. Just to give you a figure, we just paid one private engineering firm a project of about $20,000 for to complete a project. So I think this is that was just one project. So I think this is a great cost benefit. We also have a one-time OTR of $10,000 for computer upgrades. All of our computers in the districts are about 7 to 10 years old, so they're in desperate need of upgrading. We're hoping to get about 5 or 6 computers for the staff. And then we also are looking to upgrade vehicles. We have a 2009 Ford F-150 and a 2012 Nissan Rogue. Our goal is to be able to be like the county highway, other agency and departments within the county that can roll over vehicles every 2 years and not have to put a ton of money into maintenance costs or buying a brand new vehicle every year. So this is kind of the first step to get everything up to that that level, and this would buy us a truck and a mid-sized sedan SUV type. If you have questions, you can ask them to my son Isaac. He's the boss now, so.
Questions, Anna? You had your hand up. Go ahead.
My first question, which is not easy, but I'm hoping the answer is short. You talked about the success with hydrilla, and this year or last year, the time goes by so fast I can't even remember anymore, the big outbreak by Wells College in Aurora. Mm-hmm. So you're talking specifically about eradication within the southern tip of...
Yes.
But are we seeing any southern movement of the hydrilla that was in the lake by Aurora? Has it expanded? Can you give us an update of where that's at?
So we can say with confidence that that hasn't expanded from this area, because it needs to either be planted by the vegetation, the growth above the soil sediment, or by tubers within the soil. and we did not see any above ground growth that would have been picked up by, you know, say a boating oars or geese. It was all pretty much, you know, a foot, 2 feet of.
Well, I'm less interested in us causing that as much as that coming to us and repopulating.
Yeah, so the Army Corps of Engineers has taken over the Aurora project and has been treating this year for the biomass. So it's a contact herbicide that will kill the above-ground plant matter. So to say whether there has been movement from when that plant or when that infestation implanted itself there, that would take a total delineation of the lake. That would be millions of dollars to try to do that delineation. But the nice thing about this lake is it's got the near shore areas that will allow that plant to grow, and then it drops off very, very steeply, very quickly. So it would just be around the shoreline edges. So we
don't know. Right. So the other question that I had was referring to the engineer. You had state aid this year for $50,000 that it will end and you want us to extend it. And you talked about one project with a private engineer was $20,000, a recent one. How many projects a year do you need engineers? What has been sort of the annual cost that you've spent on engineers compared to what you have now for this? And I'm assuming you have projects every year that are going to need an engineer. So my last question would be, why a one-time? And do you have plans for funding this in the future with the intention of keeping him since he's retired? I don't know what your longevity on this one is.
Yeah, so a couple questions there. I'll try to address each one. The dollar amount and number of projects. Right now, we have about 15 projects that we're ranking for about a $60,000 pot of funding that we have from the state to do implementation of projects. So we have a lot of projects on the docket ready to go, wanting to be implemented from municipalities, from private landowners, highway departments. The amount that we spend on engineers, so we apply for a project, and then we incorporate that engineering cost into our grant application. So we usually have about 1 to 2 grant applied projects every year that have an engineer on board. And those engineering costs can range anywhere from $10,000 to $15,000, $20,000.
But then we're not paying for it. We're getting that out of state money, and this we would be paying for. But you're saying maybe you could get the grant money to extend farther. Is that the logic?
Well, I think we could do more projects.
Okay. Yeah. Thank you.
Will, and then Mike, and then Martha.
Thank you, Jim. The other thing that was, I'm glad to hear about the hydrilla. The other thing that was in the news this summer, of course, was the blue algae. And are we doing anything to address that, and do we know what the cause is?
Yeah, so we are actually working with the Community Science Institute. We, through our Finger Lakes Lake Ontario Watershed Protection Alliance funding, we are monitoring that. If there's a harmful algal bloom, we're trying to target the locations of that, monitor for phosphorus, E. coli, and get different parameters within the water quality. In terms of what, you know, you can do with a harmful algal bloom, it's caused by nutrients. So the more projects, more best management practices that we can get on the landscape to reduce nutrients, the less and less we're going to see of harmful algal blooms. You know, Owasco Lake, they're still trying to figure out, because they're not seeing the spikes in nutrients, but they're still seeing harmful algal blooms. So DEC is still trying to figure that out of why, what is the correlation there. So I know DEC Cornell has been trying to do some very robust studies to figure that out very quickly.
Thank you.
Mike.
Could you go back to your slide about your revenues as a bar graph?
Yeah.
That one. Why, the purple is your revenues bringing in, you said.
Yeah, so the purple and I guess it's white there. Those are grants that we bring in. So grants will change year to year based on what we get awarded. The programmatic revenues that we get are fairly secure programs. So like our FLOPA program, our Ag Environmental Management program, that we have a line item in the Environmental Protection Fund for.
So it was hard for me to see the white bar. So that means that one's up. Is that right?
Yes. Yep.
But the purple is down.
For the grants. Yeah. Yeah. And okay. So the purple, the reason that's down is we were pretty conservative with our estimates because we haven't gotten all of our award letters yet for our grants. Right. So
you helped me. Thank you.
Martha.
Bill, is one of my questions. You said the governor recently gave $1.5 million grant to districts, and then you said actually to our district.
Yeah, so the entire award amount was somewhere in the range of like $25 million to 11 counties.
25, you said?
Yeah, 25 okay. million, yep, to 11 counties in the southern tier. And the Tompkins County District got $1.5 million of that to put best management practices or environmental incentive or economic incentive practices on farms.
Okay. How does that relate to this? Is that a different kind of grant?
In terms of our revenue here?
Yes, I mean, is that...
So that's part of the program revenue.
Okay. That's why that's up?
Yeah, so $1.5 million was the total amount that we received. We received that in different rounds. So the first round was about $600,000. The second round was the remainder of that balance.
Okay, and... on the vehicles,
mm-hmm.
You said you'd like to replace vehicles every 2 years. You want to get on that cycle?
Mm-hmm.
Well, how many miles are on those vehicles?
Right now, the Rogue has about 50,000, and the F-150 is about 60 to 70.
So those are newer than both of my cars, but mm-hmm. So... do you resell them?
So the Kelley Blue Book for the truck is right around $8,000 to $9,000. The Blue Book on the Rogue is like $5,000 to $6,000, and a new vehicle, I mean, $50,000 was kind of our cost that we looked at from the county projections for a vehicle.
For yeah, one or for yep. two for how so. Many 50,000 for two vehicles?
For two. Yep.
Okay. Yeah, Jeff.
So that's where they are now. What where they're trying to get to is if you can turn these vehicles every couple of years, we can buy them, they can buy them so inexpensively that if you can turn them in a couple of years, the resale value is awfully close to what we pay for that vehicle when we acquire it. So you get that nice turn, you get a good resale, and the maintenance cost, because it's so new, often it's under warranty and often they're very low. So it's kind of the best of all worlds. The hard thing is to get there in the first place, and that's what they're trying to do now.
Is to start that program of ICE.
Right.
Okay.
John, a couple things. One, nowhere in the presentation, and probably didn't need to be, is the FTEs and how many people do you now have working in the district?
So with the new engineer, six, including myself.
Six, okay. And the important number you said at the beginning, given the dust-up that we were involved in many years ago, we're down to that number?
38,000.
38,000, which we were obligated to pay back over time. Any other questions for John? Go ahead, Dooley.
There is... one of your programs is called Soil Group Worksheets.
Mm-hmm.
Are you analyzing soils, or are you using the old state soil maps?
So that is that's an old program that's been in existence for a while for tax reductions for agriculture. To basically, we come in and we are using the NRCS soil survey.
The old maps. Okay, so yeah. To the extent that they're correct, that's fine, but there are lots of questions about them.
Yeah.
My recollection is that your way of working with farmers is to convince them that you're helping them. You have no stick to make them do what they should do. Mm-hmm. Is that right?
We are a total voluntary agency.
Yeah. So that's hard.
Mm-hmm.
But you're doing a good job, so thank you.
Any other questions for John? Thank you, John.
Thank you.
I love the picture of the baby. Transportation plan is up next.
Down arrow key. This one? Okay.
Hi. It's good to be here. this is my budget. Most of the change of $3,592 relates to over target requests for a gadabout. Most of my revenues, virtually all of the revenues come from grants, and we're still waiting for an award from the state relating to a large part of this. So depending upon what that award is, it will change my budget or keep it the same. I do two things. I do federal and state grant management, and I do mobility management, and I want to talk about federal and state grant management first. It was interesting this year that for the first time the state had some new capital grant programs for TCAT, and the last time I was here, or the last legislature, the meeting, you approved an application for $1.4 million for TCAT, and the next day we got the award letter. So thank you. We don't know if this additional funding will continue into the future. It could be a one-off. So we'll take it on a year-by-year basis until we see what the pattern is. Federal funding is very important. It's very important for TCAT. It's important for the county. And the only words I can say is uncertain but hopeful. Hopeful being that when the administration earlier in the summer proposed very significant reductions in federal transit funding, it involved capital programs that only large metro areas used. So it didn't touch our programs. So I guess that is hopeful. Next year we have a triennial review, which basically means every 3 years TCAT staff, some county staff, and myself have a lot of work to do. It's an assessment of the county, TCAT, and other operators' compliance with federal rules. And hopefully we will wrap that up in April, and we can get on with 2018. Mobility management. Sometimes I have I've tried to explain this in different ways, and so I have a different way to try to do it for 2018. We are really looking to coordinate the development of mobility options that are affordable, effective, and efficient to meet individual transportation needs. And we're working both with supply and demand, and we learn a lot from the needs of individuals. Because frankly, not only are you assisting individual people who are facing real significant obstacles and barriers to the mobility that they need to go to work, to get health care, to do many important things in life, but you're also learning where your failures are in your existing services and systems, mostly failures of coverage or failures of time of delivery of services. We plan for sustainability. We really want to make the information, how we deliver the information for people to assist them, that they learn how to use and to use services as easily as possible. As I said, we learn from customers. And I work with all mobility service providers in the county, public, nonprofit, and private. And so we have a pretty good idea of what's going on within the county. Just want to talk about some, like, three basic strategies that we're looking to go forward with in 2018. One is this is building regional partnerships. We've been doing this for a year and a half. We received some funding from the state to do this. And as you may recall, in 2013, the ITCTC published the regional transportation study, in which we sat down with our six neighboring counties and worked on issues relating to intercounty travel. So we have one program that Cornell Cooperative Extension is running for us, which is Move Together in New York. This is a regional mobility management program targeting intercounty travel for employment and health care, and really looking how to develop effective, sustainable options for rural residents, especially when you're looking at the seven county area total around us. It's primarily rural, and rural mobility is a very significant issue and challenge. The second regional partnership is the Finger Lakes Rideshare group. It's coordinated by the ITCTC. And we're very happy to announce that we added Binghamton University to the list of higher educational partners and the county using this rideshare software. And we have plans. We have done presentations to Tioga and Cortland County. And we are looking for these and other counties to join us. Technology. TCAT has wonderful technology projects that they will tell you about, but they were really the first out of the bat, first at bat to really begin deploying very significant technology projects that greatly enhances their customer service and information, and we applaud that. Gadabout has an IT project, and it's the subject of the OTR. The IT project would completely reorganize their operations, trip reservations, customer information. They are using software from 2000, and it's time for that to go away. We will also look to create a new platform for open trip reservations for other community mobility providers. And this is a very innovative thing, and we're looking forward to working on that. Smartphone apps. We need more smartphone apps. We need smartphone apps in the public domain so they cannot be canceled and withdrawn from service. These are ideas on how to use smartphones to make mobility services accessible and usable for members of the public. We especially have a need to work on how to assist limited English proficient individuals to access information and use our services. We need to apply more innovative business strategy models. We're always looking for good ideas from other places in New York and around the country and in some places in other parts of the world. We need to evolve our volunteer driver services that have faithfully served our community, but their membership is aging out, and we need to look at this in a fresh light and use technology to have efficient operations and become a Medicaid transportation provider for these services to be financially sustainable. Another thing we need to really look at is a mobility call center where people can make reservations with multiple service providers and a one call. And this is something that, frankly, we're talking about today with a group of people across the region, and we're very much looking forward to that. It's just me. Our over target request is for $3,571 as a one time to help provide the local share for Gadabout's technology project as they retain a consultant to help them scope out the rest of their project. Thank you very much.
Question, Anna.
So the first one is obviously about the OTR. You had given a presentation in Health and Human Services and then a presentation, I think, in Transportation about the concept of mobility as a service.
Yes.
And I know that that is actual technical software that would allow the end user to see what, wherever they are, to see what potential modes of transportation are available to them and connect with them from one app. Is that correct? From one platform?
That's how some places have done it.
Is that, I mean, I know that Gadabout is one of many services that we have. It has been hit because of some of the regulations at the state with taxis and the medical
yes.
services supports. Is that a possible way of bringing Gadabout into a central role in the transportation services that we have, to have this IT upgrade be looking at creating that as a possibility?
Not for that particular project. I mean, they really need to essentially reinvent and reorganize how they take trip reservations for right now about 60,000 trips per year, and how they dispatch and how they know where all their vehicles are, and how they can then create apps so their customers know where their vehicles are. So
you're saying they're so far behind that to get what
that
they need.
Isn't what that wouldn't. I don't see a mobility provider being the agent of change to do mobility as a service.
This one in particular, or any of them?
I think that there might be one or so who has capacity in terms of customer service expectations that they could be very good at doing this.
So the OTR is specifically for the consultant, but there's a large grant that they already have to do the actual buy the software and implement it. Is that true?
Well, they don't really have that yet. The purpose of the consultant is to do the scoping so they understand what their options are. There's a broad range of options. For example, there's paratransit dispatch software that is in the public domain that may be useful. There's others that are coming from different types of vendors. There's different ways to bake this cake.
So they don't have the grant yet?
They do not have what they anticipate, all of the funding they're going to need to actually purchase something. So what the OTR is for is to help with the cost of the consultant. Gadabout receives 80% of this cost is paid by the feds, 20% is paid by Gadabout. And it just so happened that they were pulling together their money and they were short this amount for their 20%. Thank you.
Mike, go ahead.
Dwight, on Gadabout, is relying on volunteer drivers really a sustainable model for this group? I know that it's always hard for them to get volunteers.
Most of the Gadabout drivers are paid drivers. And it is hard for Gadabout to get paid drivers. It's hard for everybody to get paid drivers.
But they have volunteer drivers too, right?
They have over time, a smaller share of volunteer drivers. Because frankly, the volunteer driver is stepping up to learn how to drive a larger cutaway vehicle. They are getting a commercial driver's license with Gadabout's assistance, and there's no difference between the paid driver and the volunteer driver other than one is paid and one is volunteering. So it isn't a conventional volunteer driver program where a driver is driving a sedan. It's a level of commitment which is very commendable.
Don't doubt it. I'm not trying to cast any aspersions on the quality of the drivers. I'm just asking, is the availability going to be there in the future?
I don't know. There's a lot of baby boomers who are going to retire at some point in time. And at one point, I can think of when Gadabout had a number of retired Cornell faculty who were driving. They taught, physics, and now they're driving. So we are a unique community as far as volunteers go. And I'll just say that. But getting drivers of all kinds takes a very considered effort.
Okay. Thank you, Dwight.
Welcome.
Rich?
I was just curious, what kind of leverage are we getting on the our input of the $3,500? What's the total cost they're getting from other sources?
Total cost is like $42,000.
Thank you.
Go ahead.
I was going to ask about the volunteers, too, but you're right about the baby boomers. I've often thought that we needed a youth Gadabout, something that parents could, book to take their kids to, this or that after-school activity that the extra school bus doesn't do. Has that ever been considered? I know you need another. It's like a hole in the head, right? You need more. But
no. This is something where we have heard before, and frankly, with Gadabout getting the capacity, the capability with the software and some of the features of it, that it could be used for a multiple of types of services. So we come up with a sustainable model, and you have the ability to increase services. I mean, one thing very, very quickly, we've talked with the Women, Infants, and Children's staff, and they're very, very interested in having Gadabout help get their clients to the health department and to other places. And when we were looking at this, it looked that there were trips that Gadabout was making where they are basically deadheading, meaning running empty to go pick somebody up, let's say up in Groton. And here, this software would allow agencies and so forth to book clients onto trips which are right now running empty.
Oh, okay. So, in other words, WIC could go online and say, oh, I have somebody who has to go back and forth.
And see how that... This technology is great. And it really gives the operator control where now they don't have it.
Okay, great. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Anyone else? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
I would like to meet with the legislators. I want a five-minute recess in Mike Lane's office, please. Because you're new, sir, we really wanted to plan the right kind of welcome. So here you are.
You're listening to our conversation? All right, thank you.
I'm glad that you called each other.
Tompkins County Area Transit.
You got it.
Or Tompkins Consolidated Area. You're on.
Thank you. We appreciate being here this evening to be able to speak to you about Tompkins Consolidated Area Transit. Last year we were here and we asked for a one-time amount of $50,000, and we really appreciated the opportunity to receive that amount. And today we're here to ask for that amount to be recommended as a continued on target amount. So we want to talk a little bit about there are influences, major influences as to why we're seeing an increased demand for our services that is coming into our service development department. So there is seems to be certainly a need for services. Federal and state future funding uncertainty, as you heard from Dwight Mingle in his presentation, that's always an uncertain amount of money for TCAT. Also, the uncertainty is the fuel costs. It is difficult to project out and predict for our budgeting purposes. In the spring of this year, we invited the planners from the county, the city, and Cornell University to come speak to us about the long-term plans that each one of those entities had in place and to better understand from those entities as to what they're looking for future with regard to transportation services. And so that was very important for us to understand. With that, we realized the next step is really to have a strategic plan and have all the stakeholders come together to develop a vision for the future for transportation services for Tompkins County. And so to that end, we're looking in late fall to do a strategic planning effort. Right now, we have an RFP out for a strategic planning consultant to help us with that undertaking. Next year, we'll be going into our contract negotiations with our union, our UAW, and we certainly anticipate out of that there will be some wage increases. As you probably all know, TCAT has had a challenge of being understaffed, and so given that, with our current budget, we do have some excess in our fund balance because not all our positions are funded. We are putting a full court press on getting all of our positions filled here at TCAT. And so with full employment as we move into future years, that's really our goal and our objective. Along with that, future increases in employee fringe benefits as well as wages. Healthcare, as we all know, is going to continue to go up and escalate in premium. We're also looking at how other alternatives and how we can manage those expenses. And then also with an aging bus fleet, we do have a bus fleet that's getting pretty old. And with that, we just had recently two hybrids go down with in need of batteries, which is a significant impact on our expense side from a parts standpoint. So we have more hybrids in our fleet, so we are projecting out and budgeting for that as well for potential failure of the batteries. So those are some major influences and that we are looking at going forward. And so we're here tonight to ask for the $50,000 to be a target, so it would be ongoing for our budget. And we would like to say that we appreciate your consideration in that. Thank you.
Questions for all the people around the table? Anyone? Martha and then Anna. Go ahead.
Hi. I was. You said you were. You're still having trouble filling positions. Is that drivers?
It's a combination of drivers, mechanics, and administrative staff.
How many positions?
We are 15 short right now, total, between 10 drivers and 3 mechanics and administrative staff.
Wow. Is there... Are we seeing any progress in getting the CDL, you know, the driver's license test locally? That was a big problem a year ago.
That's a huge problem for us. It's still a problem.
What we just learned is that, and we got notified, that Ithaca can no longer do the road test in October, mid-October. So we would have to go to Canandaigua, Rochester, Syracuse. So that is going to be a challenge for us as we move forward.
And there's, I mean, I thought we had, that there were parking lots that we had said, you know, want to try here, that NYSEG parking lot, airport, et cetera. No?
I'm not sure we ever heard back from NYSEG. I do know that Mike Hall is working on a plan to pave some of that Warren Road lot that we've talked about for the state DOT to give it a surface to allow this kind of testing to occur on that lot. He's trying to find money. He's also trying to get some engineering work done to know kind of how to build that pad for this kind of testing. So that's ongoing.
Is the NYSEG lot okay to use? Is that in shape to use, or is that? And is the lot the big problem? Where to do the test? Is that the roadblock, so to speak?
Yeah, I don't know that NYSEG was a viable location, and I don't have any information on that.
We approached NYSEG. It was passed on by Bob Pass of NYSEG to the his folks, his superiors, I should say, And we, that was over a year ago. We still have had no response from NYSA.
I have one question. You're asking for the county in the 50K OTR, and you want to make it a target. Obviously, you're asking your other two partners for the same amount of money.
That is correct.
Okay, thank you. Martha.
So I'd like to re-up this conversation with NYSA. We've had a lot of interactions with, you know, way above Bob Pass's, you know, pay grade. And I think we could get a different, you know, certainly more response, if not necessarily a yes. Are you saying this is the lack of a lot is the reason we're going to have to start testing 1 to 2 hours away from here?
As far as I know, there isn't any approved lot here from the Department of Motor Vehicles to do the testing. And therefore, we're going to have to go elsewhere, and we got notice that we have to go elsewhere mid-October.
Okay, we're getting some news out of New York State. It's like not really good news. I think it's time to ramp this up. And I'd be happy to get people in touch with NYSEG. And if you want to send me a quick blurb about what it is you need, how often, how many hours, what the use would be, how much space you need, I will send it to the CEO. We've been in touch with him. We've met with him about another issue. Joe, did you have something?
No, I don't have any other contacts. So yours are probably better than ours. I think Maureen may also have dimensions.
Yeah, Maureen was the one that started this with me anyway. Yeah.
Maureen Reynolds?
So Maureen Reynolds. Yeah.
Okay, the other issue is the DMV. I mean, again, who's making decisions like these, and can we ramp this one up too? I'm thinking about the corrections decision.
Will, you had your hand up.
Yeah, thank you. $50,000, hopefully, to get from the three partners. It's not specified. This is just general operating expenses to cover a shortfall. Yes?
Yes.
And wasn't recommended, but Joe, I was trying to scan. Did you support this or not?
Well, kind of. Let me make sure that everybody has the same understanding. So TCAT is not looking for more money. They're asking for the same amount that they received the year before, last year. However, what we've given them in the past couple of years is one-time money. So it's gone in 2018. What we've done in this budget with TCAT is to say this would now be the third year of the extra $50,000 that we're calling one time. And maybe it's time to just recognize that as a target expense of the counties. So, again, no more money. They're not asking for more money, but just to make it a target expense as opposed to a one-time expense.
Okay, and you would support
yes.
that. Okay.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Anna.
A few questions. I heard that that you got electric buses or are getting to electric buses through a grant from the state. Is that true?
Yeah, it's not confirmed yet, but that's what we're shooting for. We really want to make a push towards sustainability on electric buses, yes.
Okay, so that's out there as a proposal, and
yeah.
When do you expect to hear from them? What's the word?
It's going to take a while. It'll be the first of the year when we hear it's the Volkswagen settlement that we're trying for, and we really think it's a really strong possibility we're going to get those.
Right, awesome. And then the app that you guys recently launched, can you tell us a little bit about it, where it is? Is it being used? Is it helping ridership?
It's MyStop mobile app, and we believe that this is going to increase ridership, or it's a great incentive for people to, you know, they'll be able to tell on the screen, they can see the buses moving on the screen, they'll know exactly where their bus is, and they can stay inside their facility until, you know, the bus is a couple blocks away and come out, and they'll know exactly when the bus is going to be there. It's really a great thing, and I think it's going to really help improve our ridership eventually once people get used to it. There are some glitches right now, but we're working on it, and I just had a comment from somebody in the back row back there that said that they love the app. So we're getting a lot of good feedback from it.
And another question I had. Let me see if I can find where that question was. I had another unformulated, but you said that the sites are Canandaigua, Rochester, and Syracuse right now. Do we have applications out for new drivers? And is this, how often would we be able to, would we need to rent those sites? Can we go up whenever we need them?
Basically, how it works in Ithaca right now, when we bring on new employees without CDLs, they come on board with permits. Then you have to make a road test appointment. It's just like you with a car. You have to make a road test appointment. There's no other way around that.
So it's independent. It's not something that we would set up and bring drivers up to. How many applications do we currently have in for drivers right now?
You're talking about applications for road tests or?
Well, there's
applicants
or?
Applicants.
Oh, applicants, okay.
That you currently have.
We have four people that we just.
There's four that we're going to be moving forward in the process.
With.
And we have
many
more applications we're processing.
The last question I have about that is, I understand we don't have the same pay rate as, say, Cornell does. I'm curious what the turnover is of people working at TCAT and then being hired out or leaving and going to Cornell. How often do you think we lose people that way?
We probably lose maybe a couple a year to Cornell.
So they train with us and then move up.
We've lost probably two in the last 2 months, actually. So.
What is the difference in the salaries or rate of pay?
It's a different model. They receive a salary as opposed to an hourly rate, and so I would need to look at that a little closer.
I'd love to see that so we can get a handle on that loss, because that's a leak that isn't great for sure.
Julie, did I see you with your hand up?
Yes, you did. If we were to make this target 50,000, which seems realistic to me, are we constrained from doing that if our other two partners don't do exactly the same thing?
Joe, go ahead.
I don't think so, Dooley. I think as long as we all match each other dollar for dollar, that's really the important thing. That's the requirement. How we raise that money, whether we take it out of the bank or we raise property taxes, is secondary. Primary is that we all make the same match. So I don't think the others would have to make this a recurring revenue source either that supports their contribution.
Well, yes, that's fine for 1 year, but if then the next year we have it as a target and a partner decides not to do the same thing, does that make us no longer compliant with the structure?
Well, I think if any partner departs from the other partners, there's an issue. So I don't think it depends on where the money comes from. I think it's how much money they put on the table in support of TCAT that's the thing that counts.
Yes.
So if the city diminished its contribution next year, then it would affect what the other two partners are obligated to do, because, as you know, we're required to march in lockstep in our support of TCAM.
So do you have an indication from the city of what they're doing?
Don't. And I don't know that Cornell has anything that's like our one-time versus recurring targets, so I'm not sure it even applies there.
They might have some input. Do you have?
Yeah, but do you feel the city's going to support that?
We had a meeting in April.
Please use the microphone.
We had a meeting in April with all three partners as a pre-meeting for the budget, and there was no objections to the. It's a flat. We're keeping it flat for all three partners from the past 2 years, so it's not like they have to increase anything this year either. So we haven't heard any backlash on that.
Moving along, Rich, and then Martha.
I heard your comment that you're trying to go towards electric buses. And could you just talk for a second in terms of cost for an electric bus versus a conventional bus? And do you anticipate the costs dropping over time on the new technology?
That's a good question. I think the second part of that would be something that I really couldn't answer at this point. And I think that anytime there's new technology, the costs eventually drop, I believe. That would be my assumption. As far as the cost of the bus compared to our conventional diesel or hybrid diesel-electric buses, it's obviously a little bit more. And one of the biggest parts of that cost is the charging unit that comes in, which is about an extra $50,000 to $60,000 just for the unit. And then the bus itself is going to be quite a bit more. I want to say on average, $150,000. Does that sound about right? That'll be my guess anyway, from what we've looked at.
Fuel costs lower?
Fuel costs are lower, and some of the performance issues that we discussed, not that you're asking this, but the question that keeps coming up is the hills here, and actually the research we've done and what we've heard is their electric buses are even better than the diesel on hills, so that's pretty interesting, I thought. So,
Martha and then Anna.
On the $50,000, so... This is flat funding, so you don't have to actually ask either the other partners. There's no special ask. It's just we're asking for the same funding as last year?
Yes, it's just a continuation from last year. That is correct.
Okay. It seems like it'd be good if our representative, hi Dan, made a specific point of this and confirm this with the city and Cornell. Last year we ran into problems because there wasn't a direct confirmation one way or another of what was going to happen.
Dan?
That was 2 years ago. Okay. And TCAT board recognized that was an issue and has taken a different process. The other thing is they have to go to us one at a time.
Right.
So if they went to the city first, the city could conceivably ask the same question. We wouldn't have given an answer yet. So they have to...
Start
somewhere and...
Oh, I know, and everybody's not on the same budget calendar, but so to them it's flat funding. I mean, did the city do a one-time thing like this? Or?
So I'm not sure what happened last year. I think correct me if I'm wrong, but 2 years ago we were going to do it as Target, and the city changed their funding to make it a one-year, so we changed ours accordingly.
Right.
Does that sound correct? Yeah.
Well, I guess a quick call to whoever one of the city reps is, or Dan Kogan, would really be helpful.
Well, as I said, they did have a budget meeting in the spring to get a preliminary answer, and the preliminary answer is yes, we're good. We're good for this year, just as we gave the same answer without being able to commit yet.
Okay.
Anna.
Thank you, Julie. That was one of my other questions that I couldn't remember. There were two. The other one is, you said you were talking about batteries. We have hybrids. How many of our buses, what percentage of our buses are hybrids?
I can tell you that there's seven hybrid vehicles that we do have.
Out of how many vehicles?
Out of 52, there's seven.
And you mentioned two of them now they're down because they need battery replacements. Is that?
Yeah, they've been replaced. We got somebody in quick to replace them, but it's at quite a cost.
Yeah. So what is the cost?
The cost was $98,000 for both batteries to be replaced.
And how often do batteries need to be replaced?
Well,
I know. Buses
I hope that's only
usage.
One time during their life cycle. So, okay. We have five other hybrid buses that we're really concerned about now, and that's...
So we got them new, these hybrids, correct? Or were they were used?
Yeah, no, they were purchased brand new, and from the manufacturer, as we got information, their useful life is about 7 to 8 years, but we got a lot more out of the battery.
How many years did we get out of them?
I think 10?
Or 11.
10, yeah, 10 years.
So do we have you guys worked into the budget of a 10-year cycle replacement for the other ones? I didn't hear you talk about starting to prep for those other five.
We did.
Okay, so that's in there.
Yeah.
Okay, good.
So if you own a Prius, don't wreck your Prius. Go ahead, Dave.
Yeah, I've been told by somebody at TCAT that the hybrids did not perform well on the hills in Ithaca. And how does that relate to the totally electric bus?
I can say we've been asked that question by our board. Dan can confirm that. And we don't really have an answer to that. And that's something we're going to have to research because that is a great question.
Okay, thank you.
Anyone else? Thank you, all three of you. Good to see you. You're done.
Thank you. Thank you. Martha, thank you for checking into that for us.
OHR, please.
Good evening. Thank you for an opportunity to present our 2018 budget. My name is Karen Baer. I'm the Director of Human Rights. And this is Xavier Rusk, who is the paralegal aide at the Office of Human Rights. Which one do I do? This one? So, what we generally like to do is to have an overview of kind of our organizational vision, which is something that we revisit on a regular occasion as staff members. It's basically our recipe for how to do human rights work and how to sustain it in a community. As you probably know, the Office of Human Rights, which is four staff members, is structured in a way that prioritizes both enforcement and outreach. So in terms of enforcement, which is what we call human rights protection, that's Xavier's job. And we have another position that does education and outreach, which is what we also call human rights promotion. And we believe that we have to focus on both of these types of strategies. It's not always clear how much education and outreach or when enforcement trumps outreach or the other way around, but we think on a daily basis about how to measure those types of strategies in order to have the largest impact. We also believe that there are a number of other opportunities we need to take advantage of. We believe that collaboration is very important, and that is a key piece of what we do. Most of the programming that we provide, we do in a collaborative way, also through partnerships and bridge building. And then we also believe that there's time to celebrate the kind of work that we do and the kind of impact that we have and the kind of vision that we still want to accomplish. So healing, celebration, and dialogue is also part of what we perceive our work to be. Most importantly, in order to sustain this work, we have to, the necessary condition is that we need the support from the public and from this body in order to be effective. So one of our centerpieces, of course, I talk about this every year, of our outreach effort is the our human rights arts competition. And this year marks our 30th annual event. So we're really looking forward to being able to roll this program out again. It's already been rolled out. This is, of course, the K-12 program. All schools in Tompkins County are invited to participate. Last year, we had record participation rates, not only in number, 800 entries, but also from a variety of schools within the district that we didn't have participation from previously. So we were very happy about that. And this year, we would like to also build on that. This is an event that is co-sponsored by the Dorothy Cotton Institute. And so it's somewhat, goes hand in hand with on Human Rights Day when the Dorothy Cotton Institute also has a gala, and these two programs work hand in hand to be effective and to celebrate this type of activity. I want to share with you some of the workshops and trainings that we've done this year so far. We created an LGBTQ safe space training video for internal training of county staff, a very short video that we presented to this body not too long ago. We also have developed and have presented Who Wants to Be a Sex and Gender Harassment in the Workplace Know-It-All, the game show, very long but catchy title. We provided this type of LGBTQ plus training to the Probation and Community Justice Department as well as Youth Services. We've also been providing LEP, Limited English Proficiency and Language Assistance Plan training to not only county departments but also to the City of Ithaca. It's a basic training to get staff to feel more comfortable about how to provide language services, some of it telephonic, some of it on-site, and to make sure that the frontline service providers at the county understand, how to process situations where customers or clients are limited English proficient. We recently developed a service animal primer for mental health service providers. We trained employees at the mental health department. It's the first time we did the workshop. It was very well received. The point of the training was to encourage mental health service providers to participate in their lawful role of helping their clients get reasonable accommodations, which include requests for service animals and emotional support animals. I've also this year done training the International Human Rights in Theory and Practice. I was guest lecturer at Cornell Law School Summer College, talking about human rights theories, mostly in an international setting, and trying to connect that to local human rights work that we're doing. Also was an invited guest lecturer at the Global Connections Leadership Academy, which was a program of the U.S. Department of State and Allendale Columbia School in Rochester. 16 Iraqi teenagers came to the U.S. And had homestays with American families. There were also 16 American teenagers that participated in the program. It was a real learning experience for me to get an understanding of what human rights work is like in Iraq. We also develop publications each year, technical assistance. So this year we created an LGBTQIA do's and don'ts in the workplace. We distribute that to people who participate in our workshops. We've provided county departments with a model transgender employment policy Some departments have taken me up on that, and I have consulted with them about how to make their policies more inclusive for not only LGBTQ, but people who are transitioning in the workplace. And a safe space policy toolkit, which is intended to be used by law enforcement and correction agencies. It's quite a technical toolkit based on federal protections under the PREA, which dictates to law enforcement agencies how they are supposed to treat transgender people in custody. But toolkit also talks about how to accommodate custody responsibilities within the workforce, within a law enforcement workforce. Technical service, this is an example of technical service. When somebody from the community, an agency from the community, requests information or clarification on a policy, we were contacted by Tompkins Community Action. They had to come up with a model service animal policy, which we assisted them with, that they had to submit to the federal and state government for various grant opportunities. We also created a number of publications related to our source of income strategy, a pamphlet that's available to the general public that we've been distributing called the Frequently Asked Questions, which is a very basic guide. And another which talks about, you know, just basic explanation for what source of income protection looks like. We also created a poster, Please Accept My HCV Poster, that you may have seen around town. It's we want to encourage as much as possible the voluntary the voluntary practice of accepting Section 8, people who use Section 8 vouchers or other types of public subsidies in order to afford rent in Tompkins County. And then we've also been talking about the issue of a fair chance for all, which is a more county-wide approach to ban the box, and informing people, especially persons with prior convictions, what their rights are and what a fair chance local law might look like. This year, the Freedom from Domestic Violence Work Group, which is made up of the Office of Human Rights, the Human Rights Commission, the Cornell Law School Women's Global Justice Clinic, and the Advocacy Center. We've been working, collaborating for the last two or three years on issues related to domestic violence. As you may remember, the project initially started with the resolutions made by every municipality in Tompkins County that recognized freedom from domestic violence as a basic human right. And what transpired this year was the addressing of the Village of Groton nuisance law, which we were concerned had a disparate impact on victims of domestic violence. And our group wrote a very nice letter to the village board and pointed out some issues that we hoped that they would consider. And then we also have Know Your Rights for prior arrest and conviction discrimination. We do provide a service for people who have prior convictions and help them with Article 23A and A in the Penal Code, which allows them to ask employers why they were disqualified due to a prior conviction. So Xavier is going to talk a little bit about what's been going on in the area of enforcement this year.
Hello. I'm Xavier Russ, the Office of Human Rights Paralegal Aid, and my job is to process all of the complaints that come in for the county. If you look at the slide up there, I see that it's a little bit hard to read, but what OHR, these enforcement stats that are up there, are from cases that OHR is receiving where the complainants have filled out the minimum amount of information in order to do a formal filing with the State Division. In other words, the 80-plus cases up there could be filed with the State Division. What we're seeing as far as people filing complaints locally, or rather people bringing issues to the office locally, is that 35% of those cases are in housing, 45% are employment, 13% are public accommodation, and there is a very small percentage, 7%, which are non-jurisdictional, which means that the human rights laws that we help enforce don't cover it. Now, if you want to compare that to to what the State Division is reporting out, the State Division is saying that they only received 9 cases from us in 2016. 78% of those cases involved employment, 11% involved public accommodation, 11% non-jurisdictional, which, again, 9 is a small number, so 1 case makes up a large percentage. But they're saying they haven't closed out any cases regarding housing discrimination from the county in 2016. The difference in the difference in what OHR is hearing and what the State Division is actually processing is staggering. There are many motivations that complainants may have for why they're not moving to the State Division, but some of the reasons that have been expressed to OHR has been a fear of retaliation, a concern for a lack of a local mechanism to address their issues. And the combination of the length of time that it takes to file a complaint and the distance of the SDHR. Just a little bit about that. Complaints that are filed go to Binghamton usually for us. And that means that if you want to appear for your fact-finding conference, you have to travel to Binghamton. Some of our cases are actually also being sent to Albany. So if you want to appear for that fact-finding conference, you have to travel to Albany. And then if you're unable to conciliate your case after the investigation, after a determination of probable cause, you have to travel to New York City for 2 days in order to appear for your hearing. Now, the other way that we look at this data is the frequency of a protected category being alleged for unlawful discrimination, called the BASES. The OHR, our numbers are looking at for the most frequently alleged BASES is disability. We've had 34 cases involving disability discrimination, 21% for race and color, 5% for age, and 11% for retaliation. And comparing that to the State Division, with their 9 cases are seeing much the same thing that we're seeing. They're seeing 33% of their cases with race and color. They've received no cases regarding disability discrimination. They're seeing 11% with age, and they're seeing 28% with retaliation being alleged as the unlawful discrimination. Of note about this data is that retaliation was alleged in all 5 cases where probable cause was found. To just share with you, this data is limited in what one can take away from it. The Office of Human Rights has joined the pilot program for the results-based accountability, and we're looking into getting case management software that can actually track cases that are coming into our office so that we can see the foot traffic for who's coming in, who's calling, who are we doing intakes for, all the way up into case outcomes. Was it an Article 23A letter? Was it a complaint drafting? And so on and so forth. This tool will be extremely beneficial in understanding unlawful discrimination as it's occurring in Tompkins County.
Okay. Are there any questions about
enforcement? We'll do the questions at the end.
Okay. So, as we already have presented to you, OHR has developed a good number of training and technical assistance programs for both county departments and outside agencies. In fact, OHR delivers these programs without any cost to participants. Programs prepared and facilitated by OHR staff are of the highest professional standard, a fact that is routinely documented by our use of before and after surveys collected from participants after each training session. OHR has also received direct comments, written and verbal, regarding the high quality of our workshops, presentations, and training materials. And on at least one occasion, I was copied on an email from a department head to the county administrator expressing high praise for just that. A few weeks after presenting OHR's Who Wants to Be a Sex and Gender Harassment in the Workplace Know-It-All game show for two county departments, which is heavily related to the subject matter of LGBTQ+, and receiving high praise for its substance and delivery, it was announced at a department head meeting that the county would be contracting with an agency in Rochester to provide oddly similar workshops for all county employees at a cost of approximately $20,000. When a department head inquired why OHR hadn't been asked to provide the training, the response was, "We decided to go with a more professional outfit." At a more recent department head meeting, I learned that the Rochester group had come to Tompkins County to give a sample training to more than 25 county employees and legislators by invitation only. After asking around, I discovered that nearly every department head in my cabinet had been asked to attend the event, while no person working at the Office of Human Rights was included in that invitation. This is, unfortunately, only one of many examples of the county's wasting taxpayer dollars and underutilizing OHR staff and expertise, a strategy which notably began in late 2015 after I communicated to this body concerns about discrimination. In fact, I estimate that since then, tens of thousands of taxpayer dollars have been systematically and surreptitiously expended by the county for the purpose of rendering the professional capacities of those working at the Office of Human Rights absolutely invisible. These expenditures include the funding of at least one administrative position, rental payments, attorney's fees, contracting with outside agencies to perform work that OHR has the capacity to provide, and completely excluding persons who work at the Office of Human Rights from government conversations and initiatives directly related to the work we do. This pattern and practice of exclusion has been frustrating, humiliating, and oppressive for me and those persons who work for me. In many ways, it is difficult to explain, except for pointing out that the Office of Human Rights is the only county office that is entirely run and staffed by people of color. Another major influence is that we continue to be in an office that is not fully accessible to persons with disabilities. Even though a year after I arrived, we were slated to move into a more accessible office space and have since learned that a longer-term lease has been signed. So we hope that those issues, that issue in particular, will be addressed. So this is what we call the boring slides, recommended budget, our staff remains the same, capacity of four, the Director of Human Rights, paralegal aide, receptionist, who is Carmen Arroyo, and she's our longest-serving employee over 10 years, and our newest employee, Kimberly Cornish, who recently took over the position of education and outreach coordinator. And we're glad to have her with us. We're asking for three OTRs, all using rollover funds. We continue to be interested in doing fair housing testing and making sure that the paralegal aide has the training that can sustain the work that we do. And hopefully at some point have the opportunity to do a human rights conference, a regional conference. Thank you.
Questions? Thank you very much. Dooley, you have a question? Dooley, do you have a question?
I do. Karen, you spent about 5 minutes reading something to us. Can you provide a copy of that, please?
Yes, I can.
Thank you. Recycling materials management.
Barbara, thank you for having us.
We have voice recording now. We have a voice recording.
All right. Hi, everybody.
Hey.
Hello, Barbara. Hi, Barbara. Okay, thank you. So, in with the new name of our department, we're very happy about that. This just shows where we are with expenditures and revenues. We've done some recent projections, and actually we believe that we're going to look better at the end of the year than this. We actually believe that we're going to come in about $125,000 ahead of budget.
Could you speak a little louder, Barbara?
Yeah, Barbara, go into the microphone, please.
Yeah, I just got to move my seat, and I'm sorry about that. Is that better?
Yeah. Okay,
much better.
Great.
Okay, so we anticipate that we'll be ahead by $125,000 this year, which on a $6 million budget, is, you know, you might think it's a lot, but it's could change with recycling markets. Equivalents, basically the only change here is a part-time person who will be acting as an assistant at the front desk. We have found in recent years we try to cut from 2 to 1, and we wind up having a serious shortfall in terms of the time that's needed for somebody to take off lunches and also covering in the scale house. All right, this is my important slide. Let me give you a picture, because I know since we're an enterprise fund, there's always a question as to what's going on. I will call going into 2018 as the year of stability, which I think is a refreshing thing for all involved, considering what we've been through over the last couple of years. We saw a very significant decline in recycling revenues, and now we're actually doing better than that. We're keeping our fees the same, the annual fee and the disposal fee, in spite of the fact that we are seeing we awarded a contract with a significant increase for the recycling collection for the next decade, a $400,000 increase. We are projecting an increase in recycling revenues, not a whole lot, but we think that's stable. Just to remind you of another important factor, we did get a grant to build a tipping area for the food scraps to be coming in commercially, and that's important because we're going to be seeing, and I'm involved in the think tank in Albany, we're going to be seeing a ban that's going to go through probably in 2021 for commercial establishments to waste less, including donation and requirement to divert food scraps from landfills. So next year, again, with a stable situation, we're not deleting any programs, we're not doing anything earth-shattering, we're continuing to provide the good services that we do. We'll be adding to the 12 drop spots we have. We have a 13th opening up in Danby this Saturday, and we're going to be adding three more drop spots next year, the idea being 20 drop spots by 2020. We have six public space recycling locations, and we're looking to add a few more of those as well. Just some visuals of what we're doing with these. We have two different kinds of drop spots that we're providing. One's our mobile unit over there that you can see. That one is to the top left is Hancock Street, one of our newer ones. And then below it is our stationary drop spot with the shed. You can see attendants in these pictures as well. They've got to be fully attended to have a clean stream. That one's in Cuga Heights. And then to the right is the Brookendale site at the community center. And we're seeing all different situations at the drop spots. Very, very appreciated. And my goal is really I'm hoping to add one in Groton next year as well as one in Newfield, because the new regulations are going to prevent it from being called a transfer station, which Newfield has banned. So that would be great. Public space recycling. This is a way of bringing recycling to places where people are just throwing things away. And top left is at the bus garage over by the library. Top right is one of our most recent ones. This is at Montgomery Park in the town of Dryden. So we've got a mix, we've got one bin for the recyclables. You'll notice that we have different openings to prevent contamination. And then the one on the bottom with Jeff Dunn in the picture, that one is at the Human Services Building. Again, let's look at the big picture and let's talk about stability. You can see that we've had a constant disposal fee for many years, and other than a dip one year before the recycling markets failed us, when we lowered the fee a little bit, we've had a very, very steady situation in those fees. I will make mention that we keep adding programs, but we're able to find ways of changing how we do things and becoming more efficient as well. This graph is interesting. It shows the total revenues and what percentage is funded by the different sources. You can see the annual fee, which everyone pays, is the majority, followed by disposal fees. And again, we administer those through trash tags with residents, coupons and punch cards at the facility, as well as disposal fees for the haulers. Recycling revenues is about 18%. And then we really don't get many, grants are a very small piece, along with any fines and surcharges and things like that. By category, in terms of the annual fee, you mostly know about the residential fee, but we also have other categories. The colleges and schools contribute, and next year they're going to go up by a couple hundred dollars. They're pretty steady. And then there's square foot charges for businesses and others in that category. All right, this is a graph that shows the last 7 years since we began the new recycling contract as to what's happened with the revenues. You can see that plummeting that occurred, and we're seeing a small rise, but again, we're grateful for it to be stable. My over-target request is simply for a plug-in hybrid that's going to replace our old Ford Escort that's really costing us too much money in repairs. We'll get much better fuel I mean, much better mileage, and we're looking forward to that opportunity. So I wanted to just present some future considerations in what we're hoping to do here. So this is my 30th year as the director. And as I look to the future, there are a couple things that I think we need to take into account. We have one of our biggest contracts expires in March of 2021. About a year and a half before that, which isn't too far away, we start the request for proposals procurement process. So that'll be in 19. Our disposal contract for hauling and where the materials landfilled all expires in April of 2019. And with every one of these, you know, you hope for the best, but I don't know too many situations. Unless we ask for less, things don't seem to go down in price. I mentioned the food scrap disposal ban. We will be in a position with our tipping area for commercial food scraps to be able to take that material and continue to bring it to the Cuga compost facility. There's plenty of capacity there. I'm anticipating a recycling growth of 5% in the next 5 years. Based on my predictions with fees potentially rising, and we have the cost of living increases and everything that goes along with that, if we keep the same level of service, we will be seeing increases in that in the annual fee particularly, and probably the disposal fee in 2021. So that's the big picture. I'm open to any questions or comments or anything like that.
Go ahead.
Trying to wrap my head around the state food scrap disposal ban, which is like dream come true, if it's really what I think it is. Is it just on commercial?
It's going to be just on commercial, just like Vermont, Massachusetts, Rhode Island, and a number of other states.
And
it's going to be for 2 tons. What they're looking at is the same sort of thing, 2 tons or more, that's generated per week in a given business, which is not very much material.
So anything under that, they're okay.
Will be exempt.
Are they going to have to pay for the food scrapping?
They will pay. Well, don't forget, we have about 160 businesses that are currently participating in food scrap collection right now.
Mm-hmm.
And they pay for the cost of collection, and we pay for the cost of processing as an incentive.
But we then sell the product, right?
No.
We don't.
There's a company, Cuga Compost, that owns.
Okay.
It's a mom and pop,
yep,
that owns the business, and they market
the
material.
So we pay them
material
to process, and then they market the material.
That's right. And that cost is a lot less than the cost of disposal.
And this is something that has already been passed?
Yes.
And it's statewide?
No, it has not been passed. It's being considered.
It's being
considered. But the chance, the governor considered it last year, and it failed. Dan, you brought the resolution forward
I remember.
That we had talked about. But there is actually a very different approach this year. I'm actually invited to a think tank with lots of key players in Albany in October. And everything that I'm reading says there will be much more in the way of donation and composting requirements.
So the last question, I guess, on that is, obviously there's so much food that is disposed that is perfectly fine and edible.
40%.
You're right.
Well, not 40% is edible, but 40% is being disposed of.
Right, but 25 to 30%
probably about 15% is edible, yeah.
Depending, but that's once it gets to the wholesaler. Anyway, regardless, is there a process in place that's going in to attempt to help divert that to pantries?
Right. Next year I've included, we have a partnership with the Friendship Donation Center.
Mm-hmm.
I've included some funds for a contract with them, so that they can actually do more education and more reaching out to businesses. And it's also part of, I'm also a member of the Food Policy Council. I will tell you that we will be bringing consideration on a local level from the Food Policy Council to both this legislature and the city of Ithaca with respect to food donations.
So just so everyone around the table knows, I know it's been a really long night, but this is one of my greatest passions, something that I teach about. One of the biggest greenhouse gas emitters in our country is the waste of food, much of it which is edible. Some estimate between 30 and 50% of all food produced in the United States is wasted. Going into the landfills, that's a huge production of methane. So that's what we're talking about right now, that people are aware.
Is that a question?
No, I just that was for all of us around
statement.
The table.
Oh, statement. Okay.
That was a statement.
Yeah. Kevin, you had your hand up.
Thank you, Jim. I just wanted to offer just a little bit of clarification about the OTR, because I know that you may find an OTR from one of our enterprise-type departments to be unusual. It's like other OTRs that you've seen tonight in a couple of ways. One is it's consistent with the other hybrid vehicle, hybrid plug-in vehicle OTRs, and we ask Barb and her department to go ahead and, like the other departments, put the increment between a standard vehicle and the plug-in hybrid out there as a policy decision. The other way, the other kind of OTR it's like is like the highways trucks, in that there's no hit on the general fund, there's no hit on the tax levy. It's all coming out of the department's own reserves. Thank you.
Anyone else have a question? Martha?
Barb?
Yes.
You do a great job. I love the food scrap program. And I'm so frustrated every time I go to, I don't know, Ithaca Bakery or whatever, and I don't know what to do with my garbage. Is there anything you can do to work with local residents, you know, where you take your own garbage in? And it seems like everything's trash, and I don't...
Okay, let's remember what's going to happen with this ban, okay? Not to get into too much detail, Ithaca Bakery is now composting their back-end material as opposed to, I mean, right now...
Stuff in the kitchen.
They don't have a system, and Wegmans also couldn't do this, in terms of their customer area. Not much food is thrown away compared to all the other stuff that goes in there. When we reach a ban, and we also can take that ban and make it even more, you know, more stringent if we wanted to, they will be required to do this right. It's all about economics for these businesses, and the driver is going to change. That's the real truth, because they're going to have to do it.
So,
but there are ways to do it right.
So, I mean, paper cups or things. I mean,
none of that stuff can go in. The food can go in, but the only thing I can say to you is there are tools to do it properly, but it takes a different level of work than what's currently going on. But they, you know, we do have suggestions. We've communicated it, and it is very frustrating.
I don't mean to pick on Ithaca Bakery.
No, there's a lot of examples.
Yeah, no, right. It's just, it's the general.
Okay.
You know, any place that doesn't use dishes that you wash, it seems that you have that problem.
Everyone else. Okay.
Thank you.
Well,
variation on this, Barb. When I'm at a place where there are side by side three different containers, I sit there trying to decipher the signs, which goes where. To what extent is contamination a real problem if somebody puts something in the wrong slot?
It's a very, very serious problem. I mean, we had issues at Cuba Compost where much of it from those kind of locations had to be thrown away. And, you know, we've developed the systems. Remember, we have attendance at the drop spots. With compost recycling trash, CRT at events, there's attendance. We're now working with Ithaca Schools, just had a meeting today. They're redoing their programs, and there are attendance now. Without the attendance, it's virtually impossible to do it properly. That's really the truth. Because it does have to, even harder than recycling, you're using live material, and nobody wants to see plastic or shreds of potato chip bags in their finished compost.
Martha.
Just quick, you mentioned the schools, and Katrina McCloy, who worked at Third Clark, her daughter is now, I'm not sure what the title is, but she's the, this is going to sound wrong, the trash Nazi. I mean, the person who stands at the trash can in her school and says, no, that goes there. And
she
that
just
goes there.
Started with Belle Sherman, and BJM is about to go, and LACS, and then we're working together with the school and the composting company, as well as our educators, and I'm pretty excited. They had a contamination rate of 24% last year, and we need less than 3. So I think we're making some progress.
Well, she's in Homer, so it's spreading.
Well, I don't know about Homer. Yeah.
Anyone else? Barbara, Dooley, I'll get back to you. I just want to say congratulations on that award that you received a few weeks ago.
National Recycling Coalition Board membership.
Yeah, that's
pretty
great.
It's going to help us a lot. Thank you very much.
Any money involved or straight up honor?
What I'm hoping to do is actually bring some money into the county through some grant opportunities. No money for me.
Okay. Dooley, you have your hand up. Mike, did you have your hand up?
I did, but it was...
But we'll Dooley and then you.
I had understood that Cayuga Compost didn't have room to handle everything that we wanted them to. Was I misinformed?
Cayuga Compost can handle up to 5,000 tons. They're currently getting about 1,900 tons, and that needle hasn't really budged. And obviously, there's quite a bit of room left. I'm involved with the state organization for infrastructure development. There might be a need for some additional capacity because the Ithaca wastewater plant is supposedly going to get into food scrap acceptance, and they decided not. The committee decided not to. So that is something as we look at our solid waste management future that might need to be looked at.
Anyone else? Thank you very much. Oh, go ahead, Mike. Go.
I was just wondering about this ban.
Please use your mic.
I was just wondering about this ban. Maybe I missed it. So the state's going to not allow this anymore? Or?
No, the state, just like with the mandatory recycling law that happened 25 years ago, the state is looking at preventing food scraps from going into landfills. And their target, much like bans in about 6 or 7 other states all around us, basically, is the commercial material. And I'm not really sure yet. I'm going to learn, I'm just entering into their invite-only list to learn more about what might be looked at. I know there's going to be haulers there and politicians and just all kinds of people. So we'll have to find out, and I'll keep you informed. Yeah.
Good enough. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Human Resources. Let me remind you, we're 1 hour late.
Good job, Jim. It must be Jim's fault.
Yeah, from the meeting.
I'm sorry?
I said it must be your fault. You're up there.
Yeah, well, it's been such a scintillating night so far.
Wow. Well, good evening, and I assure you I will move through this lengthy presentation quickly because you do have it before you in writing, so you can ask questions at the end if you'd like, okay?
Thank you.
Okay. So the first preliminary screens, you've all seen the recommended budget and the changes from the previous year. This screen is essentially the same as last year, just
for informational purposes, describes the main core functions of our department and what we do. For the FTEs, based on the fact that we are requesting an OTR of a part-time position, I did insert some historical information and comparability with regard to staffing of human resources offices. Major influences on the department are primarily department staffing levels. Each year we report that we have these upcoming retirements. They're getting closer and closer. So we have three long-tenured staff members that are anticipated to retire within the next 1 to 2 years. So as you can imagine, that's a significant loss of institutional knowledge. We also have been working short-staffed, 1 to 1.5 FTEs short, consistently over the past couple of years due to absences. Another major influence is labor relations. Currently, all four of our bargaining units are in or will re-enter negotiations in 2018. We just recently ratified with corrections, and their contract is expiring, you know, at the end of the year. Road Patrol, we just ratified last year, and they are already expired. And we're currently in progress with making progress with the blue-collar and white-collar units. So also I put there the climate survey. Many of the findings of the climate survey directly impact program areas of Human Resources Department. So I anticipate that the 2018 survey findings will also result in initiatives that we will largely participate in, and then increase legal and regulatory mandates. That's pretty continual. Labor laws are frequently changing, and in one way or the other, they impact the operations of our department, and we are tasked with keeping abreast of those changes. Also, another major influence is just our desire for continued process improvement. I won't go through the entire list, but those are some of the programs and initiatives that we are striving to either sustain as new programs or enhance. And the list is pretty, it's not all-inclusive, but it's pretty detailed there. And I just added a couple pictures from the recent annual picnic and from the float that was built by a team comprised, kind of spearheaded by the Human Resources Department. So priorities for the department I've listed there are essentially compliance. You know, our audit readiness is a real critical factor this year and in the next year or two. It's been approximately close to 10 years since the last civil service state audit was conducted here, so we can pretty much anticipate that we're due for another. There are also several program areas that we need to audit within our department related to important labor law compliance matters. So we always need to be aware and make sure that we are performing our work in a compliant manner. So we do need to do some in-house auditing as well. Training's been in the works for the past year. However, recently it's taken a bit of a turn, and we're hoping to transition it to more of a intermunicipal shared services program, perhaps, in some aspects. So that's a rather new development. Performance management, there is a strong need for the development of a countywide performance management program. I've been speaking with various departments and they've been sharing their practices, and so into 2018, hopefully the earlier part, I'll have the time to explore that further and put together a work group to move forward with that. Policy, there are many administrative policies related to our department, as well as other departments, but the policies relating to our department, we are very interested in making time to update them to reflect our current practices. And then employee relations, they really shouldn't be at the bottom, but that's where it fell. But it's extremely important to the staff in my department that we take the time, have the time, to do individualized career counseling, one-on-one leadership development and coaching, and provide guidance to department heads. We are frequently called upon to do so, and it's a very rewarding part of what we do, helping employees and or leaders to succeed and to help improve their department work climates. So the over-target requests supported by the budget are as follows. They're pretty self-explanatory. The new ID badge printer, last year we embarked on a countywide ID badge program where we are now preparing the ID badges for the new employees for the majority of departments throughout the county. We have been utilizing a hand-me-down ID badge printer as a cost-saving measure, and we're pretty proud of that last year to not have to expend that money. But we're finding that it's pretty much on its last leg, and so we are requesting to purchase a new ID badge printer. Part-time position, this is now starting with the OTRs that are not supported by the budget. One is to retain a very valued part-time employee in our department who's been instrumental in helping us through a lot of difficult times with regard to our staffing levels. She exhibits excellent customer service, has quickly learned many new facets of the operations, and she's really a vital resource, not only for the department, but for the entire county. A part-time position, the addition of a part-time position, allows our department to be more strategic and to, you know, focus on some of the key imperatives, not only for the department, but for the county. I listed some below, and it's not necessarily that this person or this position will perform these duties, but it will allow the reallocation of existing staff to enable whatever staff members we deem are appropriate to do this work, to do this work. Right now, everybody has a very full plate, and it's very difficult to devote time to strategic initiatives while we're balancing the day-to-day mandates and emergency situations that arise. Yeah. So another OTR to talk about is the reward and recognition program. Last year, this body approved pilot funding to implement a countywide reward and recognition program. So we began doing some new initiatives this year and planning for some additional enhancements and so forth. We were awarded $10,000 last year. $5,000 was allocated towards the county picnic or the employee picnic, which is a fantastic event, well received. We did diminish the funding to the point where we did have to scale back on our other planned initiatives. So that's why we're asking for an additional $5,000 this year so that we can continue our efforts in the recognition programs mentioned and complete, you know, plans that we have begun to make with regard to on-the-spot and peer recognition and annual employment anniversary milestone recognition and such. And the draft plan is there for you. The bullet points there are excerpts from data that supports the benefits to an organization in having a reward and recognition program. So recruitment funds, this OTR, this came about after discussions with several department heads and actually the finance department, and it was determined that when there is a need for paid recruitment programs for mainly for higher level positions, but not always. Sometimes it's a difficult to recruit position. The funding is not budgeted by individual departments, so finding the funding in a department's budget then becomes a problematic, complex exercise of budget line transfers and various shifting of funds and such. So that places an administrative burden on the department, finance, our department, et cetera. But more so than that, there are great efficiencies that could be made and cost savings in having a central pool. It would be a functional standalone fund, so any remaining balance would go back to the general fund. The savings, I gave one example below there, and this is an actual savings that we could incur as an example. You know, in purchasing paid advertisements one at a time, they're quite costly, but if we can bundle package, you know, a dozen postings, say, for the year, the savings would be realized, as I described above, quite a significant savings in being able to do so. But we wouldn't be able to do that without a centralized fund because, like I said, for each various vacancy, the recruitment funds are paid by the department. So that's the reason for that. The other next one is about the countywide training program. The county training program has been extremely successful and beneficial. We currently today started another cohort in a high-level leadership development training program, and feedback already that I've received from its first day today is extremely positive. So we have a cohort of 10 county leaders or emerging leaders that are participating in that. The utilization of the 2017 funds are illustrated in the graph there provided. And so it is the desire to change the request, converting the funds from one time to target for continued program sustainment. We have found that this funding is really, it's been a great resource for departments to enable training and development programs that they wouldn't be able to accommodate in their budgets. So it's been extremely well received. It's been a morale enhancer and confidence builder for our employees. And then I listed some of the key training imperatives that are on our forefront of our minds going into 2018. The other OTR, the next one, is the Labor Council. So most of you are aware that we have engaged Labor Council for many years to represent the county for our Road Patrol bargaining unit. It's in the Human Resources Department budget line item under professional services, the retainer is, currently. So the proposal here is to expand the scope of the coverage of this labor council firm to cover all bargaining units across the county. And in speaking with many of my peers at a recent state conference, many, many counties use this labor firm and are satisfied with their results, but all of the other counties that utilize the firm do utilize them across all bargaining units. So we were different in that respect, and so they came with a, you know, the proposal to give this a try, to gauge the value of it. In my opinion, we're already experiencing the great value of having this expertise specific to labor laws, specific to union negotiations and disciplinary matters. They've already begun to assist us in several quite complex situations involving employees, and have begun to assist us in a one of our collective bargaining unit sessions that are due to begin within this month. So in addition to participating in the labor negotiations themselves, you know, and providing advisement, they are available and will assist with employee disciplinary matters and settlements of such. And they have a great record and reputation of their success in settling employee disciplinary matters and avoiding going to arbitration a high percentage of the time, which would result in a cost savings for the county in reducing the number of times our employee grievances go to arbitration. So that would be a benefit for sure. And they also provide expert counsel and guidance on other matters related to labor laws, a wide variety of labor laws. So we would have that. The compliance and reduction of risk of liability to the county is very value added. We did recently experience where we were poorly advised by one of our vendors regarding an area of labor law. And thankfully, in running it by our labor council that we're talking about now, they were able to inform us that we had been ill-advised and we potentially could have gotten into a serious situation, and they are now handling it, and thankfully so. And then just some statistics there about, you know, it's quite remarkable. I always am so thrilled to see the high number of employees that are recognized for their tenure of employment here with the county. It's very rewarding to see that. It's a great attestation to the county organization itself that it has so many employees that choose to spend the majority or entirety of their careers with the county. So we, as I mentioned earlier, we want to recognize folks at those increments of 5-year, 10-year, 15-year milestones and so forth, and the reward and recognition funding will allow us to do so. The other data is just some, you know, indication of some of the work we do. You know, our department administered 100 civil service examinations with 671 candidates. In comparison with our, you know, local counties, while I have not put up the statistics there, we do have a higher number of exams that we offer in comparison to the other counties our size. So that is just an testament to the, you know, our interest in trying to bring in, you know, a diverse qualified talent pool to county employment. Applications reviewed, those statistics there. What's not shown there is the 2010 level, which was a little over 2,000 applications. So with the implementation of the online application process and system, you know, the number of applications received more than doubled, which is statistically appropriate, and it happens in organizations that do that, but it's a wonderful boost for the county in doubling the number of applications received annually, and therefore enriching our talent pool. The spike in 2014 was related to two uniformed examinations that were held, and what's not showing there in 2015 is on top of the 5,620 applications. The department also reviewed an additional 1,500 applications resulting from a statewide director of facilities examination, and that examination is due to be held in 2018. So we can expect to have an additional probably at least 1,000 or 1,500 applications to review in 2018 for that as well. So that is it.
Rich has his hand up. Go ahead, Rich.
Of the, I think there's five OTRs that aren't supported by the budget.
Yes.
What's your priority?
So I did list them in priority. I will have to look here. In the presentation, they're listed by
priority. So in the order they're in?
But personally, my first priority really is the part-time position. Without the adequate staffing levels, we find ourselves just unable to adequately fulfill our mandated obligations and requirements and go above and beyond.
Yeah. I just wanted to know the priority.
So that would be my first number one priority.
Anyone else? Martha.
And so these are, it's a joke question on the sheet. So you've got, so if something's under that second to the last column on the right, that's local, that means it's Target.
Yeah, you've paid with property taxes.
Because it comes Target coming out of property taxes. Okay, so you're seeing the, but that personnel assistant, is shown as one time.
Right, so my thought there, and I've talked to Amy, if this becomes a project assistant, paid as a personnel assistant, that has an 18-month term on it.
Okay.
Project assistants do. And that would satisfy her need. At least that would give the department a chance to kind of gain its footing and see if this is going to be a permanent need. So my blue color is that modification. They ask for it as Target. My suggestion would be if you're going to do it, think of it as an 18-month one-time.
Okay.
Thank you, Joe.
Okay, and then, I'm sorry, Jim, the department head searches you've got.
Yeah.
25 under local, but 15 under modification. Do you think that would be a better number?
That's exactly right. So the blue means they've asked for 25,000. I think this is a valid request. I mean, I know there's a couple of searches right now. We're spending a lot of money. I just don't know that 25 is right. I would think maybe 15 might suffice.
Mm-hmm. Well, you don't have to leave. Then we don't have to do that search.
Oh, I do.
And I don't disagree with Joe. I mean, we kind of calculated the number. I asked Rick for kind of historical data, but it's really uncertain how many, positions and what the exact cost would be. 15,000 would certainly go a long way in helping us to achieve cost savings and efficiencies.
Dooley and then Anna.
For the slide that's up there now.
Yes.
The reclasses, were all of those at the incumbent's request?
So that is a culmination of many types of classification projects that we do in the scope of our work under civil service law. We've tried to break it out with a little more detail this year. And so reclassifications of people and positions, those are could be instances where either there's a request by the individual or department head due to a change in the scope of the work or changes in the minimum qualifications of a position by statute, things like that.
So I was particularly curious about whether any of them had been initiated by an incumbent thinking they were doing more than was reflected in their job.
Yes, that does occur.
So was that one out of the...
I don't have the exact number of how many of those cited were those particular instances. And I have to say that they're evaluated on a case-by-case basis. So each time our department receives a request for reclassification, we have to review it and ascertain whether it is truly a legitimate reclassification situation. So by law, by civil service law, reclassification is appropriate when there is a significant change in the scope of work being performed or the level of duties being performed. So more work or more work of the same nature or similar nature doesn't constitute a reclassification. So we really have to analyze those in order for us to be compliant with civil service law and redirect to the employee and or the department head what actions can be taken with regard to modifications in the job description or removal of work that could be considered out of title. If an employee is in fact performing out of title work, that could be a problem that could involve union, you know, implications and things like that. So we do our best, but every classification request that comes in requires careful analyzation and review to determine its legitimacy.
Okay.
Anna.
You talked about ID badges. Yes. How much are those being used? What's your feedback? I see you guys. I see that, but I expect that from the whole administration. But well, what's your experience been? Where are people using them? Just curious.
Well, I think that the directive that was administered out, communicated out, was that it was a requirement that employees wear their ID badges. Departments had the discretion of modifying that to the extent where there were employee safety concerns and whatnot. You know, sometimes there are issues such as safety concerns with identifying themselves.
Whenever they're in buildings.
But it's safety, you know, it's safety when we're entering off-site buildings, et cetera, and even for my staff that are at job fairs and other events, things like that. Awesome. Very, very helpful.
The individual counseling that you talked about, the one-on-one coaching,
yes.
Can that be performed by our EAP?
Well, while our EAP program is very robust and can provide a lot of types of counseling, what I'm referring to more is specific to our organization and working with department heads in, you know, managing employee behavior. So it's pretty specific to our organization, although at times, I mean, I very well could say, you know, hey, you might be better served if you sought their guidance. The EAP program can provide services such as that, but what I'd like to do is have a more hands-on approach in my department with myself and Michelle and others regularly do this when requested and just meet with employees. Joe and I have discussed career counseling to assist employees who are maybe feeling stagnant in their careers, and we don't want to lose them.
Got it. And there was one just sort of yes or no-ish question. You said every 10 years or so we're up for another audit.
Yes.
And that we're up now, is that something that's going to take funding for us, or that's
no, that's what I'm talking about. There is the New York State Department of Civil Service. They circulate around the state, and the fact that our audit was conducted for Tompkins County almost 10 years ago, we're about due for another. So we should, you know, be reviewing our processes and practices and just be prepared. I don't know anything definitive. I'm just, the timing is such that we should be prepared. And there are other program areas that should be audit ready that
Anyone
are
else?
Not civil service. So,
any other questions? Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you. Okay, thank you. So do I need to do anything with this? No? Okay.
As the chair of the committee, I apologize for us being an hour late, but all of you have some responsibility in that also.
I know. I'm going to ask for another question, which is about the commission report, commission meeting.
Yeah, I'll do it really quickly and then come back to it later because it is late. Many of you saw the I sent an email out earlier today. There was a meeting of the Commission of Corrections. They had intended it, now we now know, to pull our variance as of this Sunday, which would have meant 18 beds gone as of this Sunday. Ken Lansing and Ray had a kind of a private meeting with the commissioners. They pulled them into a private office. Ken made our case. The best he could do was to get another 90 days. So our variance has been extended for 90 days, but with a stern warning that, at least in the commission's eyes, that that's it, that they're not going to extend the variance any more. So as of December 31st, that'll be the last day that we can operate with 100 beds, and we'll drop down to 82 at that point. We need to think about strategies and tactics and all that. There's a budgetary issue that we have to think about. 18 beds, pretend that you boarded everybody out, 18 more people, $558,000 a year. You're not going to see that, but that's the kind of number you're looking at. Politically, there needs to be some consideration about, you know, is it too late to reach out to the governor and others in state government to see if we can get some relief through that source. So that's what we know from the meeting today.
Thank you for the comments. We're back here Thursday. Rural libraries, TCPL, airport, CCE, contingent fund, and the backbreaker, the county administration. Thank you all for coming.